ready. Would you like to share about silence, please? What is the intention? I think there's several intentions, and everyone can have their own intention also. Sometimes it's nice to know that you don't have to talk to anybody. You can just be quiet, you know? Everybody's quiet. There's no noise. But so that's kind of a funny joke. But also when you're not talking, you gain a lot more control over your speech and your mind also. Because if the mind is not allowed to just come out, to act out, then it has to be it becomes very conscious of what the thoughts are, what the thinking process is. And then you have control over it because it's not going to kind of come out of your mouth. And so if you practice melon, like you say you're doing one day a week and then every morning, it gives that it gives some inner space and inner control that usually you don't even realize that you might need that, because it so kind of unconsciously comes in the mind and out the mouth. But once it hits that barrier, then you start to develop a different relationship to the thoughts and the thoughts that you have, and also the things that you end up saying. It gives you space between your thoughts and your words. So words coming out, you know. So in that way, I think it's good. It's a little hard if you're not into it, and then it's kind of forced upon you. That's not, you just have to kind of go along with it. But if you can make use of it, because say we decide every Sunday is going to be melon, and every morning up until after the meditation is melon, then that just creates can be kind of a tapas. And I would just, if you're going to all agree to do that, then I would just be with it and see what the effects of that are. You know, it's individual for people. You know, it's in a way, it's a little bit like fasting. You don't like it at first. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But after 2 or 3 days go by, there's really a pull. You know, but it's hard to make it through those first times because you're habituated to something else. I don't have too much more to say. Yeah, and I remember doing it at the ashram when I was, you know, there like in the 70s. We used to do it usually once a week, or sometimes we would do it for 3 or 4 days. Like maybe not every month, but periodically we would do several days. And that's nice, really. It gives you a lot of space, inner space. So I used to like doing it for 3 or 4 days better than one day. Because by the time I finally got into it, it was over. Mm-hmm. How long have you been bathing in this knowledge? How has it changed your mind, body? Well, I've probably been immersed in this knowledge and in this study since 1972. So how long is that? It's quite a while. That's almost 40 years, isn't it?
45 years?
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, 45 years.
We're going to have to have my 50th birthday party. Or whatever you call it. And that's good. Yeah. I've been really immersed in it because that's my priority, really. you know, burning those courses and being in Swamiji and all of that. That's karma. So, and I can't imagine it any other way, my life going another way either. It wouldn't be me. It wouldn't be my life. So, how has it changed my mind? I'm much more patient, much less angry. And I like to be with what is. And I think that's just how you mature in this knowledge, you know. Your life slows down to Ishwara's time rather than to living out the Jiva Srishti, which is really chaotic in a sense, because you're always, if you're in the Jiva Srishti, then you're always, you know, kind of imagining into the future, wondering what you're going to do next, or worried about the past, or whatever. You're not here. Your body's here, but you're not here most of the time. Probably the majority of the time. You're lost in the Jiva Srishti. But that settles down tremendously to the degree that, you know, you, over time, you own up your knowledge on an emotional level. And you enjoy being in real time, you know, and seeing how Bhagavan unfolds things. People can get frustrated because they want you to be making decisions. But people want to make decisions before it's time to make the decision. You know, that's a problem. And that means, let's worry about this. Let's worry about this decision that's going to have to be made in the future. You know, let's work this out, this decision. I know it's not time to make the decision yet, but let's try to make it anyway, somehow. And I'm kind of joking, but not really. You know, what if you give the decision to be time to mature in Ishwara's time, you know? And then the decision becomes not a decision, really. It becomes the obvious next thing to do, the next involvement. But because as Jiva Srishti, you see so far ahead, you know, what could happen and what the decisions I'm going to have to make. You have no idea what decision you're going to make, and then people will fret about that. But the fact is, you have no idea what decision you have to make because it's not time to make that decision. The pieces aren't together. You don't even know if you're ever going to have to even make that decision. It could just, the whole idea of making the decision can be just a fabrication in your mind. And actually, there's no decision coming in the future that you're going to have to make around that. So, it's really wonderful, actually, to really spend much more in the present. And that's not to say there aren't decisions in the present to make, but those decisions are there to be made right now. And the time is there. And so if you're just dealing with what is in your more or less immediate present, you know, then you have everything you need for that decision, and the decision is barely even a decision, because all of the pieces are, you just watch Ishwara unfolding and you're responding to that unfoldment. You know, I used to learn so much from Swamiji on this, because he was running, this was like in the the real experience for me was when, like in the early late 70s and early 80s, when we were running these courses in the States. It was just a shoestring budget. There wasn't really very much money. And I was the accountant and manager, and the accountant with another my student. We used to do it together. Well, sometimes there was hardly any money to even go get it to the next day, but by the next day there would be money. And Swamiji, he never bothered about it at all, you know. And I liked that. I really thought that was great, to just watch him never bother. Because I used to give him a sheet, a balance sheet, that the computer would spit out, you know, tell exactly what all the expenses were, what the income was, what the balance was, we had in the bank, just printed it out, I'd give it to him every day. You just look at it and just toss it around. Mm-hmm. But he never bothered. And he took care of things and everything always worked out. It's not like he did. He did whatever he had to do, but it always worked out. You know, but some of the board members and some of the people who are doing construction used to be having heart failure. Because there's no money for you to... We can't go ahead and do this when there's no money in the bank, Swamiji. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. It was really good. It's a really good lesson. You know. He always just did what needed to be done. And he said that once. Somebody asked him... I've told you the story before. Somebody asked him a question, like, kind of like, what it is like to be a Jnani Swamiji or something like that. I don't remember what the question is right now. But what he said is, I just do what is there to be done every day to the best of my ability. And he said, and that's it. That is so simple. Here it is. All these things are there for you to be do, your responsibilities, everything that is here for you to do. You just do it, you know. You're here in the present. You do what is to be done to the best of your ability. And the next day there's another set of things. And the next day another set of things. And life goes on. It's like the things that need to be done, you know, keep unfolding. And you're very busy doing all of these things that are there, your responsibilities. And they're not going to stop coming. You know, but and there's no Jiva Srishti, there's just really Ishwara Srishti here, because here it is. So you're nicely here in the present, rather than worrying about the past and the future. So there's more Shraddha in the Prarabdha Karma, in the very reason that you got this life, took this birth. And you see your body is kind of... Your body is part and parcel of Ishwara, like every cell in your body is part of the body, you know. It's so contained by all of the laws of the creation that you're not at all outside of those laws. And so it's good to, because it takes a while to kind of build up that Shraddha or that trust, so you can do experiments. Like spend a week just trying to do what's here to be done. And not be concerned about the future. Be concerned about... Because the future will be the present in a little while. You know what I mean? We don't even know what the future is. But it will become the present. And we're only really living in the present. So you can try. And just see, you'll be plenty busy. But you'll also be very engaged with everybody. It's not like you won't have things to do. And then let the future more or less take care of itself. But the future, there is things you're taking, need to be taken care of now that concern the future, but they're in the present. The concerns of the future that are taking place in the present right now, and then you do those things. But there's a lot of imaginal life out there. And then, you know what the problem with all that too is that we, in the imaginal life, there are imaginal circumstances that are frightening or scary. And so you have an imaginal life that is triggering real emotions, like catastrophic thinking. You're making, it's all Jiva Srishti. It's all made up. It's fears and what's, it's all made up. But it triggers emotions that are real, in the sense that they're not made up emotions. Oh, look at those emotions that character is having. No, it triggers my own emotions. And then I have to live with those emotions that are triggered by my imaginal future, which is really awful, honestly. It's much easier to deal with the emotions of the present, not the imagined situations of the future. And that's usually our conditioned situation. We worry about these imaginal situations. So it's really nice to get grounded. You know, life is so much more simpler. I don't know how it's changed my body. It's probably more relaxed than it used to be. But no, I won't say any more. But I'll just keep those things to myself. If I understood right, you said that in deep sleep we experience consciousness and causal condition of the mind, so we never really experience only consciousness. Oh, yeah, I probably, if I said we experience consciousness, there's no experience of consciousness. Consciousness is the experience. That's what we mean by consciousness, your being, is what we call swaprakasha. It's self-shining. Or if we say swetta siddha, I'm using these terms over and over so that they become natural for you. Swetta siddha means it's self-established, which means it doesn't require any pramana for it to shine, to be present, to be known, because its very nature is consciousness itself, and so its very nature is known, not with a knower, but just as self-evident. And so if I say this is known, this is known, this is known, the self is known, the is-knownness is just the self-evident nature of consciousness. And so now if you say, so just to change the language, that if I, in deep sleep we experience consciousness and the causal condition of the mind. So let's say it this way to be more exact. Consciousness is always there, timeless, and it is its own self-experience, not a subject-object experience, but just consciousness is self-evident. This me, like the me that you are, there's nobody illumining me. I am my own self-evident experience. If the whole universe went away, all time and space and all subject-object relationship, this, the me experience without a subject-object would be there because it's self-evident consciousness. And so in the deep sleep experience, you have this self-evident consciousness, and then the karana sharira, the causal body, which the in the deep sleep state, the sattva, the mind, and the sense organs go into causal condition. The prana is still working, keeping the body alive. The karmendriyas, the organs of action, are actually in kind of a paralyzed condition because of chemicals that are released so that the body won't be moving around, otherwise you'd be sleepwalking. So all of these things happen in this deep sleep condition, but what we're most notice the most noticeable change for us, since the body keeps on breathing and the pranas are functioning, you know, and our body is still there. But in terms of your experience, the sense organs and the mind are in their causal, or the sattva is in its causal condition. It means it's not active at all. There's no subject-object differentiation. There's no nama rupas, there's no variety of experiences, there's just one big ajnanam that is mitya, and therefore mitya has for its being, as everything mitya does, has for its being consciousness. And so in the deep sleep experience, there is the sattva in causal condition, which is naturally illumined by self-evident consciousness. So that means that this sattva causal condition itself is an experience. But when the experience is just like any vritti that you have, any thought modification, that is an experience. It could be a thought or an imagination or an emotion or whatever is going on in the mind in any given vritti. That is known because of the consciousness. The knownness of the vritti is the consciousness. That then gives it, the vritti, the sense of being known, because sattva as though reflects consciousness. Okay, so in the deep sleep state, the sattva goes into that causal condition, and so there is no knower known subject-object relationship there for anyone to be marking that condition or commenting on it. Like being the knower, there's no one there to act as the knower of the vritti, because this knowership is not real. The knowership requires that in the vritti is awake, the ahankara identifies with the conscious aspect of the vritti and calls it a knower. Knower is just a language. There really is no knower. There's just conscious being. In terms of experientially, we have names for the knower, but those names are identifying with the consciousness in, like, the thought processes, you know, or that make you call yourself a thinker, or identified the consciousness identified from the standpoint of the sense organs. You call yourself a seer or a hearer or a taster or whatever the sense organ is. But actually, you're labeling your experience like that. But if you get rid of those labels and just look at the experience, there is consciousness and the vritti. The consciousness is the luminary, the is-knownness, and then of the vritti, and that's labeled as the knower. And then the vishaya, the subject matter of the vritti, is known. So, and that's just the vishaya. It says it is known, but the is-knownness doesn't belong to it. The is-knownness belongs to consciousness. That's the nature of consciousness. That consciousness reflected in the vritti as though illumines the content of the vritti, whatever that is. So it is the vritti is known. So that's the reality of what's going on, but there's no ahankara now. There's no one to identify with the consciousness in the vritti as me, who is the knower of the known. So in any vritti, there's consciousness and the object of consciousness. And so the ahankara, the mind labels the consciousness as the knower, seer, hearer, you know, and it labels the object of consciousness as what is known. So you have this knower-known dichotomy here, built up. And that is not going, that knower-known part is not going to happen when the vritti has for its vishya, for its object, you know, the subject matter, ajnanam, where there's no duality, there's no commentator, there's no one, there's no ahankara that says, oh, I'm the knower of this ajnanam. Right? The ahankara is not there. And so all there is consciousness and the ajnanam, which is the subject matter, the content of that vritti, atisukshma vritti, causal condition. And so now, when you wake up, what happens is this duality, knower-known duality, comes back. And then you can talk, your mind is active, it's not in causal condition, your mind is active. And then you say, oh, I had the deepest sleep. I slept really well. I didn't know anything at all, you know. And then I ask you, you know, when you're in deep sleep, is there like a knower-known? Are you aware that you're in deep sleep? Oh, no, I don't know anything, just a total ajnana, totally nuts. Yeah, that's how it is for me too. Yeah. So if I understood right, you said that in deep sleep we experience consciousness and causal condition of the mind. So I would say there is consciousness and the causal condition of the mind, which is mitya. So we never really experience only consciousness, not in deep sleep. Well, let me put it this way. In one sense, we always experience only consciousness, but then it's always also combined with whatever the mitya experience is, so both are going to be there. But in nirvikalpa samadhi, which is different than nirvikalpa ajnana, right? The mind is not in causal condition. And so in that case, when the mind itself is just turned toward consciousness, it's like resolving into its own being. At that time, consciousness is illumining a vritti which has nothing in as its vishya other than consciousness. And so when that's the condition, then instead of being just an ajnana vritti, it's just a vritti that has for its vishya, its subject matter, its object, consciousness itself. So then you have awareness illumining, you know, awareness. And initially when that happens, and it's nirvikalpa samadhi, initially when that happens, it's called savikalpa samadhi, because even though the only content of the mind is consciousness, because it's like a mirror. The outline of there's an awareness that, oh, it's like, without even the words, it's kind of like, ah, I'm just totally with myself. But you're aware of yourself that is totally with yourself, like that, something like that. But then if you hold that for a few minutes or whatever, not even that long, a few seconds, it will, that mirror of the mind will just be overwhelmed by consciousness. And that's what we call nirvikalpa samadhi, you know. And so then at that time, there is no objectifiable experience other than consciousness. So the mind is as though overwhelmed, so it's not even recognized. But when you don't recognize there being any mind there, but when the mind comes back, then it has, just like in the deep sleep, it has a memory of that condition. But it's going to be, there's going to be something else that happens. It has a memory of that vritti, that nirvikalpa. And so knows completely, the buddhi knows completely now what that is. But the really interesting thing about it is that memory of that absorbed state that we call nirvikalpa samadhi is true to myself, who continues to be exactly that. And so now, when all the other vrittis start coming, because the mind is now not absorbed, and there's this vritti and that vritti, this emotion, that emotion, that nirvikalpa self is totally revealed as me, and I'm never coming and going. So there's something very convincing about the nirvikalpa samadhi, and we call that akhanda akhara vritti in the teaching. Because it means, say, when we're unfolding this vision, your mind is following along, and then you see it. That's a moment of nirvikalpa. Like, it just, you see it. And that's the teaching methodology is supposed to do that. It's supposed to take you to that recognition. But now the mind recognizes that, and then the mind goes on doing its thing and having other vrittis. But it is recognizing the independent nature of your being, which then when it goes on doing other things, you're the one that remains, because you were the one that illumines all vrittis. You are the self of all vrittis, but this one vritti, jnana vritti, is turned toward yourself, and so now its vritti nature is overwhelmed, just leaving you as you are. And then the mind becomes extrovert again and has all of these thoughts. But you're still there, the one who's always the luminary of every vritti that exists, or if no vritti exists. And so it's not, what's interesting is that if you have a nirvikalpa samadhi or the teaching, akhanda akhara vritti means a vritti that whose akhara, whose nature, whose form is akhanda, no subject-object relationship. Akhanda means it's not split into anything. It's just the self. And so since it's yourself, when that vritti goes away, as all vrittis go away, that absorbed vritti goes away, what has been removed is the ignorance of yourself, because yourself remains without... Yourself doesn't go away when the vritti goes away. So the vritti removed the ignorance of yourself, but it didn't, of course, remove yourself. Whereas for everything else, when the vritti goes away, the object goes away also. It's not you can have a memory of it, the object. Say, like I'm looking at that batik there, that hanging, whatever it is, bedspread. I like it anyway. These are nice too. Okay. So what I'm saying is, like, if I am looking at this, I have a vritti, a thought modification true to that. Okay, and so I have the experience of that. But if I look away like this, I don't have that experience, because I'm not that. And that also requires consciousness to illuminate. It's not self-evident. So if now I have the experience of this, now I don't, now I have to remember, have a memory of it, I can do that. I don't have the experience. But now say you get self-knowledge, and your mind gets that recognition, that viveka, and your mind then is focused, just focuses or absorbs into your own nature, and then of course being the mind, that vritti goes away. But you don't go away. Now the ajnanam has been removed that was causing this superimposition. Because now you recognize yourself in the midst of all of this is no different than yourself without all of this. Because yourself is a sangha. It never changes or takes on the shape of anything. That requires maya. That requires the mind and the sense organs and, you know, subject-object relationship and all that. All of it belongs to maya. But yourself is totally free of all of that. So. Yeah, so we never really experience only consciousness. Yes, you do. Because consciousness is never separated from maya as long as I have this body. When we say, in a sense, the self is always separated from maya and never separated from maya. From the standpoint of maya, the maya is fully dependent for its being on the self, on consciousness. But from the standpoint of consciousness, the maya doesn't touch consciousness in any way because it's mitya. And so it's not as though your body is stopping or changing the nature of consciousness or covering consciousness in some way. It's never covered consciousness from the standpoint of consciousness. It's covering consciousness from the standpoint of the mind that has self-ignorance. But there's no covering on the part of consciousness by mitya. It's like the pot can't cover the clay. It can really try, but it has no prayer of covering the clay. Because the only thing really there is clay. So that whole universe doesn't make a dent or touch consciousness in any way. But you're only experiencing consciousness from the standpoint of the upadi, you know, from the body, mind, sense organs and the sense of touch and, you know, that pervades this body and all of the vrittis and emotions in the mind that enjoy consciousness. You're experiencing the consciousness from the standpoint of those vrittis, of those emotions, of those knowledges. So it seems as though there's somehow that you never get to experience consciousness as long as you have a body, consciousness in and of itself. But in fact, that isn't true because this world is mitya. And so it doesn't contribute to consciousness really from its own standpoint. Doesn't do anything. That's what we mean by mitya. That's a little heady, but it's good to contemplate on it because it's the way things are. Please talk about manam. Oh, this is a manam. Okay. Why is it a valuable practice? And how to approach it internally. I think I just talked about that, what that is. But it's interesting that it's coming up. Do we have to do this? Do we really have to do this, manam? I mean, am I getting something out of it or not? That's how I read that. Because I used to feel that way, but then I changed it over time. What is love in the meditation the other day you instructed us to differentiate the me from emotions like anger, grief, and so on, and then you said something like we are love. Isn't love also an emotion? Yeah, it depends, you know, like that's part of the task. It's like differentiating on the word ananda, like wholeness, fullness, bliss, joy, happiness. Aren't these, you know, the positive spectrum of emotions? So then isn't the ananda, you know, like an emotion also, like love and bliss and happiness and joy are positive emotions? So it's kind of the same question. That's why That's why I think understanding ananda or love, these even English words, Sanskrit words, they're all in the end, none of the words are any good. Only because all of the words that we have are tied to experiences that exist within duality, experiences that come and go, experiences that are dependent upon a vritti or a thought modification. That's the problem with all of the words, even like sat and chit, let alone ananda. Because existence, there's nothing here that goes on existing that is free of time. Consciousness, who would even guess that there's pure consciousness and not the consciousness that is the quality of the knower known? You know, but all we also have a relative understanding of these words. And that relative understanding can be used in such a way using these prakriyas that you strip it of its meaning, its meaning within duality, and leave just that which is the non-objectifiable self. But that's all of these teaching methodologies are meant for that. And all of the words that we use have to have the finitude stripped off of them, you know. Like say if you say a word like love, actually in nature, probably the best word, and we'll see this actually in Panchadashi I'll read that little commentary for you that's coming up probably tomorrow. The best way instead of saying love is the beloved, that which is the most dear. And then, but you say, yeah, but what is it that's the most dear? Well, that is actually for you to discover. And you discover that by being with yourself, like when we do meditation, and you ask that question. Because the other wonderful thing about it is that you can be sitting with yourself and then thinking that the ananda means bliss, and then you would just think, well, how am I going to invoke that bliss? You know, so that I can see what myself is like as bliss. But if the self was bliss, it would be bliss all the time, because yourself is not away from you, it's you, and it never changes. So the better question is, if when I'm just with myself in contemplation, meditation, let the buddhi ask, what is the most dear? Why does the Shastra, why does the Vedanta, the Upanishad say that I am the beloved, I am the most dear? What about me and my experience right now is the most dear? That's a really beautiful meditation. Because you can't say, well, it's not here right now. There's no bliss here right now. So somehow I have to get that experience. Yeah. That's not the question. The question is, why does the Upanishad say, I am the most dear? Myself is the most dear. What in my experience right now is the most dear? And you have to contemplate on that. Because that is there right now. It's just, we don't notice it. It's funny that we don't notice it. But we don't. It's in competition with the different vrittis that are calling our attention. So the thing is that no matter what's happening, it's always in reference to myself, always in reference to my own well-being. You know, everything is in reference to my well-being, the one who is the most dear. You have to play with the language a little bit and see, recognize that. And you recognize. I mean, I remember when I first recognized that, it was like, oh, that's true. I recognize that which is the most dear. It's not something that's away, it's you. But then you have to recognize it. You don't have to create an experience of it. You know what I mean? like you have to create a bliss experience or something. You don't have to create the experience. You just have to ask yourself and let the buddhi have that little task. Yeah. And recognizing that. And then contemplating on the fact of it. And until that becomes natural, a natural recognition for you. Okay, we're going to do one more. Maybe. We'll see what it is. You teach us. You teach us, and we see that there is no mind without consciousness, but there is consciousness without mind. Can you give us several examples of it, please? Okay. We have to think of it like this. When you say mind, think of vritti, right? Because this will make it easier to understand. The vrittis go on changing, right? So this vritti comes, this vritti is there, it is known, right? The vritti, when the vritti is, consciousness is. When the vritti is not there, this is that anvayavyatireka. When this vritti is, consciousness is there. When the vritti, that vritti is gone, consciousness is still there. It's more like this. The vritti is, consciousness is. The vritti is gone, the next vritti it comes. What remains is the constant, is consciousness. And so consciousness never comes and goes. The vrittis, and by vrittis we can also use the word, but there will be vrittis, every experience that we have. Every experience we have is really in the form of a vritti. But every experience that we have comes and goes in consciousness, which remains. Consciousness never comes and goes. So I am always there. The one, you could say like, I'm always here, another language, I'm always here. I'm the one, you know, who is present to all the experiences that come and go. But I'm the only one that stays. There is no experience other than me, which is not an experience as an object, objectified experience, is that I'm an experience of self-evident consciousness. I am the only experience, you know, as conscious being, self-evident consciousness, that doesn't travel, that doesn't come and go. It's a good meditation. It's a really good meditation to just sit there and see all of these vrittis and this and that coming and going, and just notice who's not coming and going. It's only one thing, and that is you. And then you can say, why am I the beloved? Because now you've identified yourself the one that's not changing at all amidst all of the exchanging experiences. And then notice that is you. The one that's not changing is you, is this me. And then you say, why does the Shastra say I am Ananda? I am the one who is the most dear, you know. Good question with that is to say, well, is there anybody else who's more dear? That starts to narrow it down a little bit. But the thing is to actually recognize the fact of it, you know, that there's nothing more dear. So that's why it's called Ananda. There's nothing more beloved, more loved than love itself, really, because there's no dvaita there. Between loved and love is not two, there's just your own swarupa. Yeah. Those are several examples in some form. Dear Radha, how can there be a memory of deep sleep in the citta in causal condition? Okay, I did this already, but I'm going to do it tomorrow after we have these classes. We have a little bit more work to do. Since I already answered this once, I'll just keep this second one for tomorrow, because this is the deep sleep state does need, you have to sit with it for a while to understand it, because it seems like, you know, I'm not conscious in deep sleep. And you're not conscious in deep sleep. The mind is not conscious in deep sleep. It's in It's unconscious. It's in pure causal condition. And so then why isn't consciousness there if consciousness is the adhishtana? Consciousness is there, but there's no mind that's reflecting it at all. So anyway, there's more to say to make it more clear. We have time for like a bunch of this. Something like mm-hmm. You want to?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or anybody else also. Mm-hmm. But you're always there, so... Just do one and then we'll do the shanti. Okay? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Prajabhyah paripalayantam Nyayena margena mahim mahishah Go brahmane pyashubhamastu nityam Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu Kale varshatu parjanyah Pratidhi sasya shalini Desho yamsho parahitah Brahmana santu nirvayaha Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarve Sham Shantir Bhavatu, Sarve Sham Purnam Bhavatu, Sarve Sham Mangalam Bhavatu, Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha, Sarve Santu Niramayaha, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma Kashchit Dukha Bhavet, Asato Ma Satyamaya, Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya, Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya, Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate, Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate, Om Shanti Shanti Shanti, Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha, Harihi Om.